Prologue. 2 weeks ago, in the Voice of America, they had bombed an airplane factory in Brunswick and barely made it back. The Germans had that ground sewn up tight, flak so heavy the birds were walking on it. Even while you watched it shred the bombers in triple group formation ahead of you, you found yourself admiring the precision placement. The Krauts had a gee-whiz mechanical computer rangefinder that directed the 8.8-centimeter anti-aircraft guns that fired a 20-pound shell faster than the speed of sound. The shells went off at programmed altitudes like deadly popcorn kernels, spraying metal fragments that punched through aluminum sheeting, cut fuel and electrical and hydraulic lines, fouled props, and shredded engines and men. And there was nothing to be done about it. The bombers had to stay level and on course because the top-secret Norden bombsite had delicate gyros that wanted a Cadillac glide once the run over the initial point began. For maximum concentration of explosive damage, the bombers had to remain in tight echelon formation, which also maximized the devastation of the flak bursts. Once the bomb run began, there was no deviating. No evasive maneuvers, no flying above or below the flak level. There was nothing you could do but ride it out and grab your lucky charms. The only good in that hot mess was that the flak kept the Luftwaffe out of their hair, because on the Brunswick mission, the Messerschmitts had been on them like starving fleas on a fat hound. Boney Mullen, their bombardier, had released with the lead bombardier's drop over the target, and they were just banking off the run to dive below the flak when they caught a close burst low on the right side. It took out number 3 engine and punched through the ball turret and shot chunks into the fuselage. Voice of America was a hangar queen. She'd thrown a rod on the mission before this one, and when Boniker, their flight engineer, had asked Farley if he could requisition a junked B-17 for parts. "Then we could fly that one instead," he'd drawled, straight-faced. "'Cause fixing this one's like taking a gator to the vet. You're just making it better so it can try to kill you again." Captain Farley had feathered number 3 after it got creamed. Then he saw that it was leaking oil. At least the goddamn thing wasn't on fire. In the co-pilot seat beside him, Lieutenant Brobin called out the oil pressure drop and reported that fuel was looking okay. He shut off number 3 fuel line and Farley upped throttle on the remaining engines. Higher RPM would eat up fuel, and the drag on number 3 would eat up more. It was a long way back to England, and now the bomber would be trying to turn right the entire way. DDB. Too damn bad. Farley got on the interphone for a status check. The crew reported that the bird was holier than the Pope, but number 3 engine seemed to have got the worst of the damage. Handsome Hansen hadn't reported back from the ball turret, and Farley told Garrett to go check on him. Garrett banged a wrench on the turret hatch and didn't get a return bang, so he cranked the turret and undogged the latches and swung the hatch down and stared into the tiny space for a moment. Then he dogged the hatch again and reported that the ball turret was out of commission and that Hansen had been killed by flak. He did not report the jagged, foot-wide hole in the side of the turret or the bloody chunks of Hansen coating the inside in a kind of frozen stew that was in no way identifiable as something that 10 minutes earlier had been a 19-year-old with big white teeth and a total inability to tell when his leg was being pulled. With an engine out, the Voice of America couldn't keep up with the flight group, so Farley had dropped out of the formation. He and Brobin watched the other bombers pull ahead, stark silhouettes in the midday sun. They counted 4 B-17s missing from the group, apart from the Voice. 2 of the remaining bombers were burning oil, or worse, and trailed dark black plumes that would be a roadmap for any Luftwaffe pilots who sighted them. Brobin had shaken his head in disgust and said, "Why don't we skywrite directions to the airfield while we're at it?" Farley nodded grimly and gave the homebound formation a wistful, two-fingered salute. Then he told the crew to keep a sharp eye out for enemy fighters. Straggling alone apart from the bomber group, the Voice was now a flying bullseye. The German pilots would go after her like wolves after a stray yearling. There'd be no help from other bombers, and the Voice was still hours away from picking up a fighter escort. Near the coast north of Rotterdam, they were spotted by 4 BF-109s. Farley had taken the B-17 down below 10,000 so that the denser air would give the fuel more stretch and the crew could take off their oxygen masks. The yellow-nosed Messerschmitts, broke formation and came at them from high and behind, 4 o'clock and 8 o'clock. The voice filled with staccato hammering from the 50-caliber Browning machine guns at the waist and tail and upper turret. The German fighters were going for the damaged wing. Oil had sprayed everywhere, and one good trace around would light her up like a fuse leading straight to the fuel cells. Instant 4th of July. But Everett scored a hit on the Messerschmitt's first pass, firing from the bomber's right waist and carving chunks out of the canopy of the lead fighter. The BF-109 veered off and corkscrewed down into the pale green Dutch countryside. The other three fighters had immediately broken off the attack. That shot of Everett's had been the lucky first-round haymaker that ends the fight right then and there, and the remaining Luftwaffe pilots seemed only too happy to turn tail. Maybe it was dinner time. Garrett and Everett usually went at each other like an old married couple, but when the 109s broke off, Garrett, a heavyweight wrestler in high school a few years ago, picked Everett up in a bear hug and carried him to the back of the bomber, laughing and yelling and calling him one terrific son of a bitch. It had been great shooting, all right, but everyone knew how lucky they'd all been. There could easily have been 40 fighters instead of 4. And if the 109s had come from below, their pilots would have seen the wrecked ball turret and started working on gutting the bottom-blind Voice of America like a trout. After the Messerschmitts had sped off, Farley took the Voice down to 2,000 feet to conserve even more fuel. Number 4 was leaking now and oil pressure was dropping. Wen reported that he could smell fuel near the bomb bay. The North Sea was white-capped and rough 2,000 feet below. Farley didn't think the junk heap bomber was going to make it across, and he sure as hell didn't like the idea of his crew bobbing like corks in that cold, rough water for however long it would take the Allies or the Germans to pick them up, assuming anyone picked them up at all. Turning back to bail out over Holland and Belgium was out, unless they wanted to ride out the war in a Stalag, if they weren't shot after parachuting in. Farley gave Plavitz their fuel situation and told him to find an English runway in range. The navigator stopped his constant drummer's paradiddles and hunkered over his charts and did calculations with pencil and paper and worked a ruler and compass on a chart and said he thought they could make the joint RAF-USAAF base at Horsham St. Faith outside Norwich. If not, there were RAF bases along the route, but they were all medium bomber fields and Plavitz wasn't sure about the runways. Farley told him beggars can't be choosers, and Plavitz sang out coordinates for the nearest field. The bum-engined bomber took some nursing. They were losing altitude and speed, and Farley couldn't get her to climb. Any slower than this and raising the nose would stall her. Farley told the crew they could either bail into the North Atlantic or take their chances on reaching an airfield. There hadn't even been a pause. "We're with you, Cap," said Wen. The others chimed their agreement. "All right, then," Farley told the crew. "Let's clean her out. Everything that isn't nailed down goes out the window. We don't have room to be sentimental here." "Sentimental, my ass," came Wen's gravel voice. "I want to jack her up and slide a whole new bomber under her." You weren't supposed to badmouth your aircraft, but Wen had pretty much given up by now. The Voice of America had begun raining guns and gear into the North Sea. Brownings, ammo, parachutes, oxygen tanks, flak suits, helmets, binoculars. Boney wanted to activate the thermite grenade on the Norden bombsite, but Wen convinced him that no German was going to snag the thing on a fishhook before the war was over. Fuel was leaking everywhere, and Wen was afraid that setting off the Norden would blow the whole damn aircraft. Boney acquiesced, and then heaved the heavy apparatus out the front access hatch. Plavitz sadly patted his sextant and then chucked it out, followed by his entire chart table. He also quietly slipped his drumsticks into his flight suit. None of the other crew would have missed them, but Plavitz would rather go into the drink himself than chuck the pair of sticks he'd been beating since he was old enough to hold them. 30 minutes later, the bomber was 100 feet off the water, and the English coast was dead ahead. Farley had the throttle shoved forward, and his arms were aching from wrestling the control wheel. "I'm open to suggestions," he told Brobin. "Set it down on the beach," his co-pilot offered. "I can work on my tan." "In England? It's still a beach." Farley told the crew he was going to leave the wheels up and try to set her down in the shallows. He ordered them to throw out their heavy flak jackets and be sure they were wearing their Mae Wests, then take crash positions. which really just meant getting on the floor with a cushion and bracing themselves. Number four burped and cut out as Farley was banking left to line up the bomber over a stretch of narrow beach. He put all his weight into turning the control wheel, and he feathered number four and told Jerry to cut power to the remaining two engines. Jerry quickly powered down the engines and generators and shut off the fuel lines, and the voice of America went silent for her last 10 seconds of flight. The North Sea blurred by on the left and England streaked by on the right. Farley kept the nose up and felt the tail touch water. The drag brought the nose down, and Farley quickly raised the flaps to help her skim along the surface. They planed along the shallows off the beach like a skipping stone. The bomber breached the chop. The crew were jolted, then slammed forward as the fuselage touched bottom and hissed along the sand. Then the left wing's leading edge bit water hard, and they were thrown around as the bomber slewed left. The aircraft ground to a halt and yawed to port. Cold seawater poured through the wheel wells and bomb bay doors. The crew scrambled to their feet and got the hell out, each man picturing himself trapped in a huge metal coffin sliding to the bottom of a freezing sea. But the Voice of America had landed in shallow water, and her right half lay fully on the narrow beach, as if her captain had ordered her careened. Farley grabbed the flare gun, and he and Brobin helped each other out the window. They slid down the hull and splashed into the cold water and slogged to the raw beach. Farley counted heads while Brobin lit a lucky and stood looking at the flying fortress half submerged in the breaking shallows.
"Keep sailing like that and you'll make admiral someday, Joseph," he said.
Farley had scowled at the beached bomber. Waves gurgled against the hull, the water around her stained with leaking oil and fuel. He looked at Wen.
"Think they can fix her?" he asked.
Wen spat.
"I'm worried they might. She was a dog, I'd have shot her 5 missions ago," he said.
Farley nodded. Then he handed Wen the flare gun.
"Here," he said.
"Put her out of our misery." The RAF had picked them up, the Limeys and their fatigues regarding the huge American bomber burning on their shore. At Horsham St. Faith, they were debriefed about the Brunswick mission and then billeted in the most comfortably appointed barracks any of them had seen since joining up. Next morning, they hitched a ride with the USAAF supply convoy back to Thurgood, where they found that their billets had been given over to new arrivals and their belongings had been divided up among the squadron, except for personal effects, which had been given to the chaplain to be mailed back home. No one at Thurgood could believe it when the 9 remaining Voice of America crewmen hopped off the Jimmy Deuce outside the mess tent. That night, the crew were stood warm beers in the boiler room, and no one else realized the survivors were toasting the loss of the Voice of America every bit as much as they were celebrating having made it back alive. They left a glass full for Hansen, and nobody mentioned him. Every man got back every item that had been parceled out, except for the food that had been eaten. Zippos, paperbacks, playing cards, clothes. Francis, their tail gunner, even got back his shadow comic books.